Welcome to BookendsBookClub.net, a service of the Team Approach. Here, we dialogue with featured authors about their books related to business management and team cultivation, as well as personal and organizational development. Our website contains study guides for many of the books discussed and related tools to help your organization excel. Let's listen in as our host Susan Stamm engages today's guest author.
My guest today is Robert W. Jacobs, who is the author of the book Real-Time Strategic Change. I am Susan Stamm, and I'm pleased to introduce Robert Jacobs as our guest today. To get a copy of Real-Time Strategic Change, visit Jake's website at www.windsofchangegroup.com. Jake, thanks for joining us on Bookends today.
Well, thanks for having me, Susan.
Your book, which was actually written back in 1994, has really been a step on your journey of helping organizations master the art of change so that they can respond to issues in what you call the real time. What is real-time strategic change, and how did you discover such a process way back in the late 80s and early 90s?
Well, let me start, Susan, by saying I was really blessed early on in my career to find my calling, which is really about how do you help people, in particular large groups, create their what I call collective future. So in the mid-80s, I had the opportunity to work with a group of consultants that were based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Kathy Dannemiller and Chuck Tyson, Bruce Gibb and Al Davenport, when they were doing some really groundbreaking work at Ford Motor Company with their internal partner, Nancy Bedore. And so real-time strategic change actually showed up in the work they were doing. They started to bring together larger numbers of leaders in Ford. This was back when they were making money, to say, what kind of strategy do we need? How do we shift the culture of this organization to be more participative? And so what started with 50 or 80 or 150 eventually grew to our working with 2,400 people who plant for the Mustang. And the launch of that Mustang, how could you, in fact, get everybody pointed in the same direction, clear, committed? And so at its most basic level, real-time strategic change is about how do you help people create their future faster?
What was really involved in developing, you know, such a comprehensive process as described in the 1994 book? You know, who was involved in this, and how long were you actually involved in really coming up with the original approach that you describe in the book?
Well, it really was an evolution, and so like any good process, there's learning and it evolves over time. So. As I said, Kathy and Chuck and the others were involved in sort of a first generation of this work, and even they, you have that saying, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and so the work that they did was based back in work that Ron Lippitt had done in the 60s around building collaborative communities. So there's really, if you talk about real-time strategic change, there's really deep tap roots back to a lot of the same concepts and approaches, whether Marv Weisbord and Sandra Janoff's future search work, even Harrison Owen's work around open space, Dick and Emily Axelrod, friends and colleagues of mine, have done work in the conference model. And if you go back to the taproots, it really goes back to engagement principles and how you can really create opportunities for people to have their voice heard in creating this future. So in the late 80s and early 90s, when I decided I was going to write Real-Time Strategic Change, actually it came out of my master's thesis. I can still remember where I was driving outside Ann Arbor, Michigan on US 24 and saying, you know what, this needs to get out to a larger audience. We can do all the good work we can, but there aren't enough of us, and organizations and people in them could benefit much more. And so I made this decision. I would take this thesis and go ahead and publish it. Immediately upon having that thought, I all of a sudden had another thought, which was I got really scared. I didn't know what it meant, but this was all in a flash. You know, if you get in an accident, things slow down. So I was like, oh my gosh, what am I getting myself into? And then I had another thought in the next moment, which actually has been a great aid to me the rest of my life, which is you can keep your feet moving even when you're scared. So I made this commitment that I would publish this book, and I think the universe or higher power, God, whatever you would say, had a good test for me, because 27 publishers said no to this book, which now has had 27,000 people buying it.
Oh, my.
So, you know, I had this commitment that said, this is important. I need to get this out to the world. And so for me, it was just a matter of finding out how to do that. Rather than whether it would happen or not, although there were a number of people who weren't so sure that that was, you know, a reasonable proposition. But as I found Steve Persante at Barrett Kohler, who was the best publisher by far, that could have led me through the process with this first book, we started to use real stories from real people in the book. So ultimately, there are 67 co-authors, if I could call them that, of this book, with people telling stories about how they've used this approach and what difference it made for them and made for their organizations.
Wow. And hats off to Barrett Kohler for seeing the power in the book itself. As you just mentioned, this book really, this work is really the first generation of real-time strategic change. Could you tell us what this actually looked like back in 1994? And you do just an outstanding job in the book and really walking people through the typical three-day event with great detail, I will add, and I really appreciated that. Could you give us a bit of a picture of this event and tell us a little bit about who would have been involved in it and what it would have looked like?
Sure. One of the things people have asked, when I started to work with different clients, they, say, well, will it work here? We've got a unique organization, and I've worked in Thailand, I've worked in Brazil, I've worked throughout Europe, in Mexico, all over the world, and it in fact always works. And the reason that it, quote, always works is because the people in the organization themselves are designing their own change effort, and in this case, their own events. So we have design teams, which are a microcosm of the folks who are coming. So, and the people who come, you go back to some basic questions to say, well, what's the work that needs to be done? And then who are the right people to do that work? And too often, I think in the past, because of, I think, paradigms, because of methodologies, the answer of who needs to do the work got answered by the constraint of people's beliefs more than it was by who are really the right people to do the work. So you might go back to 1994, and if you can imagine walking into a very large room with table groups, round tables, eight people at a table, and, anywhere from 30 to 50 tables or more, stationed around this room, and a podium, and little things make a big difference. So the podium always on the long wall, not the short wall, so that nobody gets a cheap seat in the sense of being in the back of a long hall. And little things like that matter. So you would come into that meeting, you'd be sitting with colleagues of yours that you didn't typically work with. We call it maximum mix. So you'd have people from different functions, levels, roles, time in the organization, because early in an event, you want to get smart collectively about what's happening inside your organization and outside. And the best way to get smart isn't actually to sit with your best friends and have the same conversations you've had for years and probably raise the same complaints that nobody's done anything about. Part of the problem with that is, in fact, you've been raising them with the same people. And I was just working with a client, and there's a saying, I don't know where I got it from, but every system is perfectly designed to achieve the results it does. right? So, obviously we got to do something different if you want a different result. And so in this case, the early parts of an event really are about getting connected to the people at this table group that are going to be your partners over the next several days. And then also getting what we call building a common database of strategic information. And because each organization is different and what they're wrestling with is different, this design team helps shape what that is. Often there was, we called it a view from the leadership bridge. So you would have the senior leader stand up and talk about what they saw happening in the organization and in the environment, the competitive landscape. And we would then have a question and answer process as part of that that also was different. So all these things track back to how can you empower people to get the information they need to make good informed decisions for themselves and their colleagues and customers and all the people that are involved with the organization. So even that question and answer, typically what would happen is, a leader would finish, they'd say, any questions? We've all been to town hall meetings. And two kinds of people react in that case. One, people who have an axe to grind, and they're very happy to raise their hand and sort of push on their own individual agenda again. And everybody knows that's what's happening. Or everybody goes quiet because, are you really going to confront this person and what's going to happen? And is it a career-limiting move to ask a question of one of these people? Well, none of that leads to learning. So what we did is figured out that you could do something we came to call an open forum process. And so these, again, they're really sort of basic common sense, but when you apply them and you put them together, Kathy, my mentor, used to say, that's where magic comes from. So in this process, you talk at your table groups first, what did you hear? What are your reactions? What questions of understanding do you have? And collectively at the table, some things would just get answered because, you weren't paying attention, your learning style was different, you didn't track the same way. So some questions get answered, and the others are more complex questions. They actually are an integration of what needs to be known by everybody at the table. Then we literally called on tables, and we had tables on deck and who was next. And so it was the process had integrity. We'd rotate around the room. And when you asked a question, the other thing that would happen is after the answer, you turn back to the table group and say, table 42, did that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Not did you like it, not did you agree with it,
right.
But, did it get answered? Because often what happens is the leader may make their best effort to actually be responsive. For one reason or another, they miss the mark. Mm-hmm. And people leave the meeting saying, see, told you so. They dodged it again. And the intention wasn't to dodge it. And in fact, we've often had, situations where we come back and go, no, that's not actually it. What we really wanted to know was this other piece of the story. And we encourage leaders, people will ask a safer question. So we encourage them, go 2-3 levels down. What's the real issue that's concerning people? And speak from that place. And, you get a more efficient conversation, but you also build a lot of trust in the process and in the people. By dealing with the issues, everybody knows what they are anyway. What we're saying is, let's put them out on Front Street. Let's put them above the table. The only way we can work on them is if we all know what they are, agree, and respect each other. Even if we have differences, let's know what those are. So, a bit of a long way around the barn, but the beginning of an event is really about getting people with this common database. And then there's a second stage, and, often these are 2 or 3 day meetings, but the middle of it is really about crafting a picture of an organization and a future you want to call your own, and you'd be proud to call your own. And there are a lot of different sort of techniques and processes and tools to do that, but basically it's looking at a preferred future as opposed to problem solving. And the problem solving is, let's find something that's broken, fix it. And preferred futuring says, what do we want? What do we aspire to create? And, all of this goes back to some very good theory base. So Ron Lippitt, who I'd mentioned had done the work around communities, Ron had come up with this research project when he was at Michigan, and he put two groups together. One was focused on preferred futuring, the other on problem solving, and they got the same task. At the end of that, they did their research, and what they found was the groups who were doing problem solving over time had decreased energy, and the preferred futuring group had increased energy. The problem solving group had increased blame. Preferred futuring group had increased ownership over the situation. And the last one was the problem-solving group had a reduction of pain solutions. You know, let's make it not as bad as it's been.
Right.
And the preferred futuring group had innovative solutions, whole new ways of looking at the situation that opened up possibilities. And so the middle part of an event is really about crafting that future. And the last part, and not to be forgotten, is, so what are we going to do? What do you need from me? What do I need from you? We even had things where functions of, you know, 100 people each would give each other feedback about how they could work together more productively. Because at the end of the day, you know, it could be an intellectual exercise and another binder on the shelf unless you really drill down to what's it mean to me and what do I need to do? What's my part to play to make this story come true?
Well, it's really an amazing, amazing process and, you know, interesting to visualize something that large taking place simultaneously. And, you know, I was curious, you know, what did it feel like for you? I realize you are really part of a team that drove this whole process, including your internal advocates that were very much a part of helping all this to come forth. But what did it feel like to be involved in something that was so large? And was it exhilarating,
well,
exhausting?
Yeah, I just gave you a very long answer to your first question. I could give you a very short answer to this one. Was felt great, mm-hmm. in a word. I mean, one of them is, you know, there are certain things in life that we're good at and others that we're not. And there's a long list of things that I'm not very good at that I need a lot of support in. And even when I try them, people are encouraging me to find somebody else to do it. I certainly have a good bit of humbleness on those things. This work, for whatever reason, is exactly what I'm meant to be doing in the world. It's easy for me to do. I standing in front of 1,000 people and working to consensus with them isn't anything that keeps me up at night. If for some people they would run the other way as fast as they could. This is, you know, coming home. And, you know, we used to say, so how do you, you know, somebody say, how do you control a group like that? And, you know, the answer is, well, that's the first problem is you don't.
You don't.
Right? You don't control them. I mean, to think you're going to control 1,000 people, you know, you're already in behind the eight ball. So the thing is, how can you work with this design team so you come up with a process that people, it makes sense to do, and they want to do it. They feel smart in doing it. It'll get them where they want to go. So part of it is having the right process. And the other, I absolutely believe this to be true, is when I'm up front, or anybody's up front in a group like that. And frankly, it's probably not even large groups. It's just life. But holding the space of possibility and the confidence that whatever it is that you're asking folks to do, that they're fully capable of doing it.
Yes.
And so standing up front, I mean, you know, if I got up there to try, and we, you know, I'm doing some work now in Europe with a retailer, and we have an event coming up, and there's a bit of gymnastics about groups that need to move and the sequence and why and how. And, you know, the logistics of these things is as important as anything else. And I said to my internal colleague, I said, well, you know, not only is it the right work by the right people at the right time for the right reasons, that certainly helps. So the other thing is, you know, I'm fully confident that they'll be able to do it, and that's the other part, you know, other side of the coin, is really holding that belief and holding the space so that people can step into it, because in a lot of ways they're doing something they've never done before.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact that you have that confidence in them to do it, it must be incredibly, as you say, I mean, it's really strongly rooted in employee engagement and, you know, motivation and all kinds of positive things that come out of this besides the change.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is that, you know, there's an exhausting piece to it. There's an exhilarating piece to it. A buddy of mine, Barry Johnson, had described one of the aspects of this real-time strategic change work. He said, by having the kind of engagement that you do, he's called it a forgiveness factor gets built in. And by that he means, you know, when I do something and I don't engage you and it doesn't work, mm-hmm. it's my problem to
right.
fix it.
Right.
I mean, in fact, you're very happy for me to have that problem. If, though, we've done it together and something goes wrong, now it becomes our problem, our opportunity to fix it, and you're more motivated, as I am, to figure out how do we make it work. And so I even believe, you know, standing up in front of some of these groups, they know I have their best intentions at heart, and I am doing my level best to try and support them. And so sometimes, you know, it doesn't always look pretty. Right? I mean, a lot of times things don't go, you know, the trolley falls off the tracks for one reason or another. But I also know that because of the relationship and rapport, and you may say, well, there's 1,000 of them. How could you possibly, you know, have any kind of rapport with an individual? But my belief behind it is they know that we're doing the best that we can to help them be the best that they can be. And because of that, when things get a little my English clients call it wobbly. When they go a little wobbly, we're all in it together and we find a way to put it back on track.
Yeah. Well, you obviously had a tremendous bit of success with these, you know, original approach of these, you know, very large scale events. What did you learn from doing real-time strategic change this way that led you to the second generation of this process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question, Susan, because, and in fact, you know, there are books being written now about, you know, why is it that the most successful companies end up in some way coming up short by continuing to do what made them successful. So, you know, my story around that was that these events are so powerful that you really could move a system through having people get engaged in them. And there's a seduction in that because, you know, like to see something like that happen and to see the progress and to see the commitment and actually see the change, you know, that would be enough. And yet, as I was doing this more and more, what I realized was something akin to, you know, I call it now the rubber band effect. There's a lot of progress, a lot of movement, a lot of commitment, and yet over time, things began to slide back to the way they were. Maybe not all the way back, but you lost progress. And as I looked at that, and I was thinking about it, of course, I grew up doing all of this large group work. The vast majority of the rest of the people doing change work did not grow up with that as their background. They grew up in the field doing team building and, you know, process improvement and a lot of the things that just, they weren't on my radar when I was doing this large group work. So I looked at this and I thought, you know, there's wisdom out there that isn't part of this process right now. And these events, however powerful they are, they're like necessary but not sufficient. Same thing's true with the small group and the infrastructure and all of the design work that gets done not in these events, also necessary but not sufficient. And so putting those together and reframing this from sort of an event-centric view, which is how I had thought of it, and saying, well, you know, this is events and a whole lot more. There's, you embed this within an overall change process, and now it becomes a tool in your kit bag, very powerful tool, but one of many that you can put in place so that when you start looking at change efforts, and putting them into the way of doing business for an organization, events are sort of a non-self-sell. They're not a normal thing that happens in organizations. So how can we take what we're learning there and embed it into daily work so that the most sustainable thing, I think, in any organization is work? I mean, it happens every day, and everybody does it. So the more you can engage people around this and make it not special, but make it part of daily work, the more sustainable the change is going to be.
So the second generation was really about getting the culture of the organization to really kind of embed this whole idea as kind of more ongoing work and activity. Were there any other characteristics of the second generation that were quite unique from the first?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that happened, and it really was sort of a key that opened the door out of what I, you know, call the event-only game, was that stepping back and looking at, so what was the essence of why this worked? And if you go to the Real-Time Strategic Change book, there's 20 principles that get sort of outlined in the first several chapters. And I was sitting with a buddy of mine, Frank McEwen, who was a colleague of mine, and we were getting ready to do a training session on RTSC in San Francisco. And so we got to the part, we said, okay, well, let's pull the principles out. These are really important. And we looked at the list, and of course, there's 20 of them. And, you know, I was joking with Frank, and I said, well, look, God's got 10 commandments, throws around a lot more weight than we do, right? And so us having 20, him having 10, or her having 10, probably we should cut these down a little more so that, you know, we're at least not asking the same, you know, as God, who's got a little more authority, so to speak. So we baked them down into six key principles, which actually survive to the day. And when you're doing work consistent with those principles, you're now doing real-time strategic change work. So it doesn't have to be in a big room with lots of people. It can be you looking at your calendar for the next week. It can be a conversation you have in the hallway. Whenever those principles are in play, what I believe happens is you get faster change that lasts longer because these principles, at the essence, sort of the DNA of what was happening in those events, you can extract out and say, okay, this can be put into the way work is done. And as soon as we stumbled into those six principles, it freed us from the event-only game where RTSC happened when, you know, you got a big facility and hundreds of people. It opened the door to it being part of daily work.
Yeah. What's really funny, almost humorous about that is, you know, the name of the process being real-time strategic change, but yet it really wasn't real-time. It was this extra event that was, you know,
exactly.
Kind of you know, this really false, not a real environment that people really worked in. So it really, in essence, the way that what you just described really is real-time strategic change. Now, is there anything different, you know, from the second generation to, you know, what you actually do today? You have the six keys from the 20 principles. Is there anything else that would define how it looks today?
Yeah, I think there's probably several elements to it, and I'll preface this with, you know, another short story that Dick Axelrod, his good friend and colleague of mine, we were sitting back years ago and talking about all these different large group approaches, and I said to him, you know, I looked over at him, I said, Dick, you know, it's a lot like dogs and their owners. And he, you know, sort of looked at me and said, you know, okay, you think creatively, Jake, but what does that mean? You know, a little always out there on the edge. And so I said to him, I said, well, you know those funny pictures where, you know, the jowly man's walking the bulldog and the woman with the high heels and the, you know,
poodle.
Poofy hair has got the, right, she's got the poodle. And so I said, you know, in some sense, what we've all done is taken what we're really good at and put a framework around it, put some principles around it, put a name around it, and now we call it our work. So the RTSC stuff, you know, if I look at the third generation, and this is sort of a natural extension of me, but I also think it has to do with, you know, being more effective. So one of it is that, you know, with these principles, RTSC, it plays well with others. So, you know, with kids, you get individual play, you get parallel play, you get collaborative play. With this approach, there are some approaches that actually don't play well with others. This is what you need to do, and there's a big book to follow and a lot of steps to follow. With RTSC, because you have these principles, really it's a question of, well, if something violates the principles, it doesn't work well with it. But I found over time more and more methodologies, approaches, and colleagues that I'm able to partner with because it's a principle-based approach rather than process-driven. So one piece of the story is that it's actually finding more places to call home and be useful because it's an open platform, right? It's sort of the difference between, you know, HTML on the web and Microsoft Word. You know, it's designed to have a barrier. This is designed to have a bridge.
Wow.
That would be one thing. Another is that looking at the principles now, and this is through work I've done with Barry Johnson that I referred to earlier, that there are some, he calls them key polarities, but there are tensions at play in any organization where it's really a both and is a better answer than having to choose one or the other and assuming there's a fixed pie. So, you know, more concretely, I think the most unique principle in RTFC is the one that we call real time. And real time now in this third generation, able to both articulate but also then apply it, I think, much more purposefully, is managing the tension, right, between planning for the future and thinking and acting as if the future were now. So you need to plan, and usually that's what most people spend their time doing. RTFC says at the same time, you need to start thinking and acting as if that future were now. In any way, shape, or form, you can reach out and grab a piece of what that preferred future looks like and bring it into today's experience. You'll accelerate the pace that change occurs.
Wow.
So, you know, I was on a video conference today with this client in Europe, and I mean, it's really interesting. The CEO, the leader of this whole organization, was sitting there for an hour and a half with us, with three leaders of a design team, an internal colleague, and me. And there was a conversation about what's going to be the best use of time in this event. Now, he said he wants to have an engaged organization. He wants to have you know, a whole cadre of leaders. So all of this is part of the plan. It's part of the vision. I even have trouble when people say, well, here's our vision for 2010 or our vision for 2015, because it puts it outside your present experience.
Right.
I mean,
right.
By definition, if I'm talking about something in 2015, it must not be true now. So Paul, in this meeting, he was literally experiencing the leadership that he said he wanted. He was receptive to it. I mean, I was amazed that, you know, the level of detail he was getting into. He wasn't micromanaging. He was partnering with everybody in that room to figure out what's a good answer for how to deal with this issue. And all the things that he's talking about wanting to happen in this organization, needing to move to a matrix structure, needing to think vertically horizontal, all of that was happening right on the call in front of his eyes. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, even modeling. People say, well, leaders have to model the behaviors. And, you know, I go, well, I don't know about you, but for me, models are people who look better than I do. They're better shaped. They wear nicer clothes. The lighting is always better for them than it ever has been for me.
Sometimes we don't even like them.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, and, you know, they end up on a reality show and you think, you know, who are these people? So the whole, even the concept of modeling, I have trouble with because it's sort of, it's not real. So rather than modeling this behavior and then sort of putting yourself above the fray, I'm going to model this for you, Susan, this is the right way to do it. Paul today, you know, he had his sleeves rolled up. He was a member of the team. Leaders were leading. He was engaging. Work was getting done. And that future was showing up today.
Wow. Well, you kind of walked us through this whole generation kind of conceptually, but if we could talk just a little bit about actual mechanics, you know, actually how this final, or I don't want to say final because obviously there's nothing that's final, but, you know, where we're at with the third generation of real-time strategic change, I mean, is there any such thing as a typical process or approach? You know, you've come a long way since 1994. Is there anything that someone could expect, well, it's not real-time strategic change unless this happens, or is it just really so fluid?
Well, you know, tough question, Susan. So I'm a consultant, so I'm supposed to say it depends, right? Not a helpful answer, though, for most people. So, yeah, I do think that you can and it's different, you know, the years ago in quality, they used to say, well, you'll know it when you see it. And it's like, okay, well, really, sounds good, but not very helpful. So in this case, with RTSC, I think, you know, one of the things that you can tell that an RTSC process is alive and well is that you have, and I'll say, the right people doing the right work. And you got to put right in quotes, but, you know, one of the things is that when I show up places, they go, you're the participation guy. Because, of course, I do all these large group events and I'm engaging people. And my answer to them is, yes, sometimes. It sort of sets them back. And I said, well, you know, one of these principles is about engage and include. And the tension to manage is between participation and direction. So sometimes the most engaging thing you can do is to be very directive. Sometimes it's to be very participative. So if you were to, like, walk into an RTSC effort, you would see a lot of different people engaged in different ways and the challenging of each other around, well, what's our current assumption and is this serving us well? So assumption busting and sort of encouraging people to look at things in new ways would certainly be part of it. You'd likely see some form of design teams up and running so that you had a microcosm of the larger system designing what needs to happen to move the system forward. And, you know, again, sometimes you'd say, well, you know, wouldn't it just be easier if Jake would just tell us what to do? Well, yes and no. I mean, first of all, then you either get, you know, you get resistance or you get acquiescence, neither of which is about creating the future. So, you know, design teams help make sure that we're not just jumping through the hoops that the consultant said are good ones to jump through. So it's a little odd, but I would say another way you would tell that this was RTSC is that you would see people designing their own change effort. You would see people in microcosms of the larger system getting smarter collectively about what needs to happen. They're almost very simple principles that just get replicated. So today we were in this meeting talking about engaging people in a meeting, and we were getting smart about things that no one person knew everything, but we collectively built this understanding and then made some decisions. Well, that's only in the spirit of then replicating that with 250 people in a few weeks. So this whole concept of microcosms and people getting smarter collectively to make decisions, that would be another thing that I think you'd see. And I also think you would see leadership showing up in a lot of different ways and places that are beyond the hierarchy.
Yeah. I mean,
the hierarchy is necessary, and it's one of those necessary but not sufficient. So people stepping up to make a difference with unique contributions that they can make would be another thing. I would have said you'd see these large group meetings, except I worked with a buddy of mine, Myron Rogers, several years ago, and for whatever reason, the organization we were working in had some unwritten cultural norm that said you could never bring more than 50 people together in a meeting. Well, all this large group stuff that I did was no longer applicable. So I sort of had to put one arm behind my back and start working, and it actually was helpful because it opened my own paradigm about, well, it doesn't always have to be hundreds of people in a room. So you might see some large group events, you might not, but you would definitely see this kind of design team concept. You would see things also happening quickly. So changes would be taking hold. And the way I talk about it, Susan, is it's like playing with house money in a card game, because you get a return on investment very quickly using this approach because change happens faster. And then the investment, the return from those early investments becomes your later investment. So it becomes sort of a virtuous cycle where the more things change, the more things can change.
Wow. What would you say are the most significant things you've personally learned and discovered by doing this kind of work over the past 25, 30 years?
Good question. One thing I know that I've learned is anything's possible. And that really, if anything, we put up our own barriers, and that becomes the limit of potential, not people in the organizations themselves. So, you know, I've been honored and privileged to be able to work. One of the projects was with the City of New York on a tuberculosis control project, and there was a pending pandemic at the time. I mean, this was really serious implications, and there were five agencies. They'd never gotten along together. They had been rewarded for not getting along. They'd never put their budgets together. I mean, there were all kinds of reasons why this shouldn't work, and they all had different protocols for how to deal with it, which in fact were a lot of the problems, because people were slipping through the cracks between them. And so, you know, was that a doable task? Well, there's epidemiological data, which you know what that is if you've worked in healthcare with the TB project, but the incidence of TB in New York City has decreased 77% over the last 15 years, year over year decreases. And so the concept of what's possible, I think I just have a much broader canvas that I paint on than I did years ago. I also think that I have learned that a lighter touch is often a better touch. So, you know, I actually, if I watch my work now, it's not that I'm not there, it's not that I'm not showing up, but I used to feel like I needed to have a lot more control over things for them to work well. And now I find myself, I mean, I was with a client yesterday, and, you know, my mantra to her counterintuitively was, care less. And I said, you know, if you care enough, nobody else has to.
Wow.
And they're all too happy for you to carry the ball on this, and you will never succeed. So I've watched myself in terms of, you know, how important do I make it? Well, it's got to be a relationship with me and the client, but also with the system. So, you know, the more I let go, the more others can grab hold. And I think that that's another big lesson that I've learned. And then the other is really, I don't know if it's a lesson as much as it is just an experience, but my curiosity about how does this stuff work and why does it work and what else could it work with? And so I, you know, somebody told me years ago, they laughed when they were working with me, and they said, you know, you have a relentless dissatisfaction with your current practice. So, you know, for me, I sort of have this curiosity. Kathy used to tell this story about Bucky Fuller. He came and gave a speech at Michigan, and she tells the speech that he told her, it was, you know, he was saying he would lie on the beach at night and look up at the stars and, you know, just sort of be mesmerized by the beauty and grandeur of these stars. And then he said, you know, and then the thought occurred to me, maybe it's the stars that are looking up at me instead of me looking up at the stars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very Buckminster Fuller-like. And so that kind of, well, I don't know, maybe this is not the case. Maybe there's another way to do this. And so, you know, naturally just challenging, you know, every day I get up and I look at something and I go, well, I don't know, maybe it doesn't have to be that way. As long as I can hold on to these principles, anything else is really up for grabs. And at the end, and I, you know, I joke with people, I say on my epitaph, I'd like, you know, the message from a work standpoint should be, it worked. Whatever it might take, it shouldn't be me putting constraints in place so that I'm comfortable with what's happening. Ultimately, it should be what needs to happen does. And this curiosity I have, which, you know, I think it's a blessing more than anything. I think I got born with it, and I'm very appreciative of it. But, it's not about the answers as much as it is about the questions. And so that's really, I think, enabled me to continue to learn, but also I think for this approach to continue to evolve.
Yeah. You've already shared a little bit about your work with New York and tuberculosis, but just to conclude our time today, you share so many stories, of course, in the book about the far-reaching impact of real-time strategic change. Is there one story, either from the book or from your more current work, that that you might share with us as we close off our time together?
Sure, and you know, I think nothing better than the present, because there are a lot of stories in the book, and people could read those, and they're good stories, and I think helpful, and you know, so the one that I would tell is probably the one that I'm you know, co-authoring right now with a lot of people, this retailer in Europe, and it's really an evolving process. So the leadership team doesn't exactly know what the right answer is at this point, and they are open and in a conversation with people in the organization that says, okay, they happen to be an off-price retailer, so they're growing by leaps and bounds in a down economy, because that's a good business to be in when people are watching, you know, watching their pocketbooks. And so this whole process, as we're starting to build it out, it's taking its own form and shape, so that there are people who, you know, are buying, they're in charge of buying goods, and then others who are merchandising, who are in charge of sort of deciding where these goods go into the stores. And these folks, you know, not unlike these city agencies in New York, they have been set up to be at odds with each other, sort of like design and manufacturing in a plant environment. You know, they have different objectives, they have different goals, and so they are designed to be in conflict in some ways.
Oh,
in this particular project, you know, we had a session a couple weeks ago, and senior leaders in each of these organizations were coming together to try and make some decisions. And you know, they didn't have a very good track record of doing things together. And in fact, sort of, I don't know what you'd say, but, you know, they'd actually done a lot of work themselves on what they thought the answers were to the same questions, but they hadn't done it with each other.
Of course.
So, you know, it's a bit of a setup for what might be a difficult day or two. And what we did is we actually thought through ahead of time and said, okay, so what are some decision guideposts, something that, you know, everybody can get behind and say, these are good criteria. We make the decisions based on criteria. We can get the personalities. We can get the historical, you know, artifacts of the demonizing that we've done. You know, we could let go of all that. And so in this process, what I'm watching happen is people getting into good conversations where they respect each other and they have some common goals that everybody can get behind, and reaching out. And when they have a question, you know, in this meeting, there was, I mean, it's remarkable if I step back from it, because there were 72 decisions that they made that they agreed on during this meeting. And there were two open issues that they left with.
Wow.
Now, you know, and you know, they were as surprised as anybody else was that they actually got there. But the way that they got there, if you go back to these same six principles and you say, well, you know, were they building understanding, listening to each other and through inquiry and advocacy? Yes. Were they thinking and acting about, you know, the future? And so the kinds of conversations they were having, the way they were having them, is actually the way they need to work together in the future. You know, this whole concept of participation and direction, we had one woman who was like hosting the meeting, and I jokingly the day before said, well, look, Nora, you're going to have to be the goddess in the meeting, because when we get to a point where nobody agrees, we can't spend the whole afternoon debating this. You have to actually wave your wand and say, it's going to the open issue wall.
Huh.
So she introduced herself to the group and said, okay, Jake said, I'm going to be the goddess today, and this is my job. And so, you know, this participation direction thing, it, you know, it worked, because when she played her card or her wand, is when people most wanted the direction. And other than that, you know, it was a bit of a free-for-all where They needed to make decisions. They needed to have conversations. So this whole concept of these principles, you know, it shows up in this process, whether it was with the CEO and designing this meeting, which, you know, most people would say, doesn't he have something better to do? I mean, really? Well, he didn't. For an hour and a half, he was saying, I'm bringing all these people together. This is the future of our organization.
What could be
I need to have my voice heard in this as much as anybody else.
Absolutely. Well, as we prepare to conclude here, what tools, training, and support could you provide for people who wanted to harness the power of real-time strategic change? Can you tell us a little bit about how you can support folks and help them orchestrate this kind of process?
Yeah, Susan, there's several ways that people can sort of take the next step. I mean, one of them, and it's a continuum, right? I mean, you certainly can read about it, and that gets you some awareness. There's work and opportunities, because once you take this out of the hundreds of people in a room situation, really anybody can do this work at any time with any number of people, even yourself. I mean, I joke with folks when I do training, and I said, well, you know, it works with, you know, a wife, two kids, a cat, and a couple dogs, as well as it does with, you know, the city of New York. So practical application, Kurt Levine had this saying once, there's nothing so practical as a good theory. And so even taking this out, whether you go to the Winds of Change Group website and you can pull some materials down, but actually practicing and doing the work based on what your understanding is one good way to start pushing the ball forward. There are webinars as well that I offer, and you can see on the website those. There's public trainings that we do a couple times a year where you can bring in a live case. So it's not like you're coming in again. You know, we did some of these trainings, and so we said, well, if it's about engaging and convening, then us running our own agenda and telling people what they should do isn't actually congruent with the principles. So, you know, you're encouraged to come with the team, bring an organizational issue or opportunity, and we'll do work in real time on that. So when you leave, you're smarter, more confident, and clearer about how you can move people in your organization into this process and partner with them in moving the organization forward. So there's things where the public training, there's the books, there's materials on the website. I've got a blog that, you know, people are welcome to, you know, put their oar in the water on. And, you know, this may sound odd in some ways, but, you know, having Kathy, Dana Miller's my mentor, you know, she had always said, you know, you go into the world with open arms. And so if folks who listen to this have a question, I invite them to shoot me an email, give me a call. There's always time, and people have made time for me. Sort of always amazed by how available folks are in the field and how willing they are to be helpful. And so it's, you know, it's sort of, you know, a bit of a circle of learning, like a circle of life. You know, I really invite people to get in touch with me in whatever ways I can be helpful to them in supplementing the work they're doing with this approach and these principles. It's not about replacing it, but it's about, you know, even bigger and better. I welcome the opportunity to learn from them and also share what I've come to know.
That's great. That's terrific, and I'm assuming that people can connect with you through your website. Is that correct?
Yeah, that'll be the easiest way to do it. You know, you can go to the website and just shoot, something to the contact page, and we set up a time. We can have a conversation. I do get around a fair bit with travel, so who knows? Maybe in a town near you soon, but really, at the end of the day, it's really about how can we help each other. Create a better world, and we do that through working together. And so that, if there's, you know, a last word to the interview, is really about what could I learn from others, what could they learn from me, and then the rest of it is a logistics game about, okay, how do we make it happen in a calendar when we can get together, But the intention behind it is pure on its own.
Well, Jake, we all thank you for your excellent work and this great resource to help build employee engagement out in the workplace. It's really been great to have this time with you today, and I really would like to encourage our listening audience to purchase your book, Real-Time Strategic Change. As I said in the very beginning of our discussion, I was amazed at the amount of detail about the process that you really shared in the book. It was unlike many books that you read about something that really don't tell you how to do it, and there was really quite a bit of detail in the book. And that book, once again, can be purchased at Jake's website, which is winsofchangegroup.com. So thanks again, Jake, for being our wonderful guest today. It's been great to talk with you about real-time strategic change. Thanks so much.
Well, and thank you for the opportunity, Susan.
Thanks for being here.